Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
I'd like to welcome you to the Tire Cover Bookstore, and thanks for coming out this evening and supporting your local and independent businesses, because it really does make a difference in our community. I just want to welcome tonight's author, whose novel I began, and I was just talking about how it was kind of getting, it was very spooky to me, and it reminds me of the interactions I've had with the ghosts that we have here at the store. This is an old theater, for those of you who don't know, so I guess theaters are always rumored to have ghosts, and I have felt things myself as my dad's a chemist. My background is in engineering. I don't come to these things easily, but yes, I still believe at this point. So this is more of a traditional ghost story in my mind, and it's set in two different time periods, so kind of present day as well as early part of last century. And you kind of keep bopping back and forth between the two as the story unfolds itself in a very spooky fashion. I think I've said spooky enough. So without any further ado, I'd like to introduce tonight's author, Jennifer McMahon.
Yeah. Thank you.
It is so wonderful to be here. I have been hearing about Tattered Cover for years, and I've been hearing all these fabulous things, and now that I'm here and have seen it in person, I see that everything I have heard is true. And what a fabulous place. I feel really lucky to be here. So thank you. Thank you for having me. And I'm even more enthused to be here now that I know that it's haunted and there are ghosts among us here. This is fantastic. What better place to talk about the winter people? So thank you very much. And it's great to see everyone out. Thank you all for coming out and being here and supporting your local independent bookstore. Yeah. All right, so The Winter People is my sixth suspense novel. I have done ghost stories. I have done kind of murder mystery books. I did a book about a little girl who was abducted by someone in a white rabbit suit. I have done a book about a girl who disappeared after going into the woods and telling her brother she had met the king of the fairies in the woods behind her house and was crossing over into fairyland. But this, The Winter People, is my darkest and creepiest yet. So at the heart of this book is a question. And the question is, what if you lost someone you love? A husband, a wife, a child. What if there was a way to bring them back and see them again? Would you do it, no matter what the consequences? And that's kind of the question that ties all the characters together through time in this book. The Winter People begins in 1908 in West Hall, Vermont, with the death, the tragic and brutal murder of Sarah Harrison Shea, who is found in her body is found in the field behind her house, only weeks after the death of her little girl, Gertie. And as we get into the book and we start reading Sarah's story told through her diary, we learn that Sarah came to believe in her final days that she had found a way to bring her little girl back. And then in the present day in Sarah's farmhouse, we have 19-year-old Ruthie and her little sister, Fawn. And they wake up one morning and find that their mother has mysteriously disappeared without a trace. And they're kind of looking around the house, trying to search for her and look for clues and figure out where she could have gone, because this is so out of character for their mom. And they've grown up in this house, and they've known all along that there are little secret niches and hiding places throughout the house. And then they discover some new ones. And in one of them, they find Sarah Harrison Shea's diary. And as the book goes along, Ruthie starts to realize that their mother's disappearance has something to do with what happened with Sarah Harrison Shea all those years ago, and a really terrifying secret that's over a century old. The Winter People came to me in a series of ideas, really. I think that writers are a little bit like magpies. You know, we go out and we look for shiny objects to come and bring back into the nest that becomes our book. And the first shiny object for me was a few years ago when I was playing a game with my daughter. My daughter was around 6 at the time, and she's a pretty funky, imaginative kid. And at the time, her games were a little bit like improv exercises in an acting class. She would give us characters and situations and then say, go. And this day's game went something like this. She said, here's the deal, Mom. We're sisters. You're 19. I'm 7. You wake up, and I'm in bed with you, and I tell you our parents are missing. And I was like, I said, missing? That's terrible. What happened to them? She said, they were taken into the woods. And I'm like, oh. And then she just shrugged her shoulders and said very nonchalantly, sometimes it just happens. And and I looked at her and, you know, a little flash went off in my brain. I said, you know, that sounds like something that belongs in one of Mommy's creepy books. And she got really excited and she said, yeah. So I got out my notebook and I started taking notes and I wrote down the idea. And then she started helping me brainstorm and coming up with new ideas. And she said, maybe there's a secret door. And I said, maybe. And she said, maybe it's Bigfoot. And I said, maybe. And I write down Bigfoot. And then she said, maybe it's the aliens. I'm writing all this down and taking notes. And she's so excited to be helping me. And I think about this idea for a few days. And all I've really got is the two sisters with the missing parents missing in the woods. And it doesn't really go anywhere. And that's okay. And I decide, you know, I've written it down. It's in my notebook. And I decide to just put it away. And that's the great thing about ideas is you can put them away and save them for later. And I have this idea that if you take an idea and give life to it by writing it down and acknowledge its existence and say, this is a good idea, and then put it away, it acts as kind of a magnet and pulls other ideas to it. So I did that with the Missing Sisters book. And then I went on with my life. And I wrote a book about a serial killer who cut women's hands off. And life was good. And I was really busy with that. And then the time came to write the next book. And I wanted to do something a little different and something with a historical aspect. So I was kind of pushing myself and I was thinking about it. And I started writing kind of just off the top of my head a story about a soldier marching home from the Civil War. And he was AWOL. He'd walked away from the battlefield. I didn't quite know why. He was in the Union Army. He was going home to his farm in Vermont. So I have him marching. And I realize as I'm writing, I don't know a whole lot about the Civil War. So I start doing a little research, and I'm reading about the Civil War, and then I get the Ken Burns documentary on the Civil War, which is absolutely phenomenal. And I'm watching that, and there's this tiny little bit in there about Abraham and Mary Todd Lincoln's young son dying in the White House. And Mary Todd Lincoln was, of course, completely grief-stricken. But she believed that the little boy came back and visited her. And then she started having seances and she became a spiritualist. And there was just that little piece in the documentary, and that was another one of those shining objects moments where I was like, I don't want to write a story about a Civil War soldier. I want to write a story about a spiritualist in Vermont at the turn of the century. And the whole book just turned at that point. And so I took my Civil War soldier, Martin, who I had marching through the fields going home, and I kind of moved him forward in time, and I changed him up a little bit, and I turned him into the husband of Sarah, my spiritualist woman. And I thought, okay, so she's going to be in Vermont in the early 1900s, and I start reading about spiritualism in the early 1900s, and I'm reading about life in Vermont farms, and I'm going along, and I'm thinking, well, Sarah's going to have a child who dies tragically, and she's going to believe that she can communicate with her through rapping on tables and seances and spirit writing and the normal spiritualist type stuff, and this is going to be good and creepy, and I'm getting right into it. And one of the things I did is in The Winter People, I tell Sarah's story through her diary entries. And whenever I worked on those, I would write them out by hand in my notebook, which was kind of fun because I'd been doing all this reading about spirit writing. And it's like, oh, I'm channeling Sarah's spirit. And one day she completely surprises me. And it's so wonderful when characters do that. You know, that when you think that they're going to do a certain thing and you want them to be a certain way, and then they just do something that blows the whole thing up in your face and say, nope, this isn't the book. This isn't going to work out the way that you had planned, Jennifer. So I'm writing in Sarah's journal one day, and I get this line. The first time I saw a sleeper, I was 9 years old. And I got chills and almost fell out of my chair, and I was like, whoa, what's a sleeper? And in spite of the fact that I write really scary, creepy books, I'm really easily scared. And I scared myself, and I wasn't sure that I wanted to keep writing to find out what a sleeper was, but I had to know, of course. So I kept going. So I kept writing to figure out what a sleeper was, and pretty soon I realized that I wasn't writing a story about a woman who believes she can communicate with her dead daughter. I was writing a story about a woman who believes she can bring her dead daughter back to life. And that's pretty creepy stuff. And it was around this time that I remembered those two sisters with their missing parents. And I remembered that idea. And it just hit me and everything came together. And I said, oh, those two sisters belong in this woman's house in the present day. And they're going to wake up one morning and discover that their mother has disappeared. And it's going to somehow be connected to Sarah and what happened with her daughter all these years ago. And it was just this wonderful moment of everything coming together. And that happens sometimes when you're writing a book, and it's almost like magic, you know? It's a wonderful thing. So that's a little bit of the background about the Winter People. And now I thought I would read a little bit. And as I said, so the story, the backstory in 1908 is told through Sarah's diary entries, but it's also told from her husband Martin's point of view. And I had a lot of, I thought that this was really important because Sarah is very grief-stricken, and I thought that it was good to get multiple points of view because Martin and others in town and Martin's brother, the town doctor, Lucius, believe that Sarah is just kind of slipping on this downward spiral sort of into insanity after she loses little Gertie. It provides a nice balance to hear Martin's point of view and Martin's perspective of watching Sarah and what she's going through as she suffers through this. So this bit is Martin, and this is about 12 days after Gertie's death. And this is pretty creepy. We might be calling spirits to us now. I don't know. January 25th, 1908. The noise woke him sometime after midnight. A scratching, a scuttling. His eyes shot open, and he lay in the dark, listening. Pale moonlight came in through the bedroom's frost-covered window, giving everything a bluish glow. He stared up at the plaster ceiling, listening. The fire had died down, and the room was cold. He inhaled, then exhaled, feeling as if the room were breathing with him. There it was again, the scratching, nails against wood. He held his breath and listened. Mice? No, too big for mice. It sounded like something large trying to claw its way out of the walls. Behind the scrabbling, he heard what sounded like the rustle of flapping wings. He thought of the chicken he'd found in the woods this morning, another one of their hens taken. Only this time, it didn't seem like the work of a fox. He found the carcass up near the rocks. The chicken's neck had been broken, and its chest had been opened up, the heart removed. He didn't know of any animal that would do a thing like that. He'd buried the body in the rocks, tried to put it out of his mind. His own heart thudding now, he felt the bed beside him, expecting to find Sarah's warm body. But the bed was cold. Had she gone into Gertie's room again? Were the two of them hidden under the covers, giggling? No. Gertie was dead, buried in the ground. Sarah, he called. He'd been sick with worry over Sarah these last days. She had stopped eating, would not leave the bed, would not feed or wash herself. She seemed to get weaker and less responsive with each passing day. Honestly, there's nothing we can do but wait, Lucius told him. They had been standing in the kitchen, speaking in hushed voices. Keep trying to get food and water into her. Give her the tonic. Offer whatever comfort you can. I keep thinking about when we lost Charles, Martin said, how sick with grief she was. He didn't want to say what he was thinking, not even to his own brother. This time it was worse. This time, he feared, she might not come back to him. It was one thing to lose poor Gertie, but if he lost Sarah too, his life would be over. I don't want to frighten you, Martin, Lucius said, but if she doesn't come around soon, I think it might be best if we sent her to the state hospital for the insane over in Waterbury. Martin's whole body went rigid. It's not a terrible place, Lucius said. They have a farm. The patients get outside every day. They would keep her safe. Martin shook his head. She'll get better, he vowed. I'll help her to get better. I'm her husband. I can keep my own wife safe. But as far as he could tell, Sarah was growing worse with each passing hour. And now, here it was, the middle of the night, and she was missing. Sarah? He called once more, listening. And there it was again. The scratching, tapping, fluttering. Louder this time, more frantic. He sat up, scanning the room in the darkness. He could make out the edge of the bed, the dresser to his left, and there in the right corner, a form hunched, moving slightly, pulsating. No, breathing. It was breathing. The scream stuck in his throat, coming out as only a hiss. He looked around frantically for a weapon, something heavy. But then the thing moved, raised its head, and he saw his wife's long auburn hair shine in the dim moonlight. "Sarah," he gasped, "what are you doing?" She was sitting on the floor in front of the closet, wearing her thin nightgown, her bare feet as pale as marble against the dark floor. She was shivering. She did not move, did not seem to even hear him. Worry gnawed at his insides like an ugly rat. "Come back to bed, darling. Aren't you cold?" Then he heard it again, the scratching, claws against wood. It was coming from inside the closet. "Sarah," he said, standing on shaking legs, blood pounding through his head, making a roaring sound in his ears. The room seemed to shift around him, growing longer. The distance between himself and Sarah felt impossibly far. The moonlight hit the closet door. He could see it move slightly, the knob slowly turning. "Move away from there," he cried. But his wife sat still, eyes fixed on the door. "It's our Gertie," she said calmly. "She's come back to us." Thank you. So, yeah, that, as I said, I'm a person who scares very easily, and writing that particular scene completely terrified me. And I wrote that scene. I was doing a workshop in a local high school. It was a humanities class, and they were doing a unit on fear, and they had read my first book, Promise Not to Tell, and they invited me into the classroom, and we had this amazing discussion about fear, and we shared all the things that scared us, and then we were talking about the senses involved with fear. You know, what does fear sound like and taste like and smell like? And then we sat down to do a writing exercise, and I wrote out the first draft of what would become that chapter. And creepy. you know, when I was a kid, I think I had a lot of fears as a kid, as I do as an adult. But I had that common fear of the closet at night in the bedroom, you know, and I would practice things, you know, should you leave the closet door open or closed, or should you leave it open a little ways? I tried putting a flashlight in there for a while, but then the battery would die, and then I would wake up in the night and there wasn't any light in there. And so I got to revisit that childhood fear and remind other people. That's the wonderful thing about being a writer, is that I get to take my fears and share them with the world. So it's great, and I get to tap into that. Do people have questions at this point? Yes.
I'm just curious if your daughter has a natural sort of macabre, or she's read some.
The question is, has my daughter read my work, and is she sort of naturally drawn to the macabre side of things? My daughter is 9 now, and she's always been, like her mom, drawn to the dark side, for sure. She has not read any of my work yet. She's tried a few times, but doesn't really get very far, and I'm not that into it. You know, she sneaks when I'm working on something on the computer. I'll catch her in my office, and she's like, "I just read what you wrote, and you had 2 F words in there." I think that's the big thrill for her right now, is looking for all the swears. But she's quite a character. Right now she wants to be a horror movie director, and we have been watching old Alfred Hitchcock movies and absolutely loving them and watching them over and over and over, and she is right into it. And the other day I was cleaning our front hall, and there was this bag. We have a bench right by our front door, and there was this bag of hers, and it was just full of junk. And I said, "What is this bag doing here? Can you come take it away?" And she said, "Mom, I can't take that away. That is my horror movie bag. I never know when I'm going to need to grab it and go and make a horror movie with the kids in the neighborhood." And I looked through it, and it's got fake blood. It's got makeup. It's got costumes. It's got notes for horror movie scripts. And she's got her little iPod that she's making little movies on, so... Yeah, and actually, so the Winter People I dedicated to her because she inspired the present-day storyline of Ruthie and Fawn with that game that we played a long time ago. And so I wrote the dedication out to her, and I didn't tell her that I dedicated it to her. And then I got the box of finished books, and I took it out, and I showed her the book, and I said, open it up to the dedication page. She opened it up, and she just lit up. I mean, just, oh, read the dedication? All right, I'll read the dedication. So it says, for Zella, because one day you wanted to play a really creepy game about two sisters whose parents had disappeared in the woods. Sometimes it just happens. So she reads this, and her face just lights up, and she gets so excited. And she says, Mom, can I please take the book to school and show my friends and my teachers if I promise that we won't look through for any bad words and if I promise we won't read any of it? And I said, absolutely. And she went to school, and she came home, and she said, I think I sold 4 books. My lit teacher, my math teacher, the computer lab person, and I gave them bookmarks. And I was like, you go, girl. Very awesome. Yes, another question.
So all your books, except for Dismantled, go back and forth with each chapter, to past and present.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of thing. How do you work that out? Like, how do you like the past, write them separately, or do you kind of write them simultaneously?
Okay.
How much of it do you have planned out?
Okay. The question is, my books, except with the exception of Dismantled, and Dismantled to some extent, but in a different way, go back and forth through time. I have the past and the present. And which do I write first, and how do I make that work? You know, I started doing it with Promise Not to Tell, and I kind of discovered the back and forth technique with my first book, Promise Not to Tell, and I thought that I was going to write a book in 2 separate sections. I thought that I was going to have the past and then what's happening now. And I was setting the book up that way, but it wasn't working. It didn't feel right. And what I ended up doing was taking the first part of the book that I had written, which was a little bit of the past and a little bit of the present, and laying it all out on the floor of my house. And then when I started moving things around, I realized, hey, this works if it goes back and forth. And then the rest of the book kind of wrote itself that way. And it's a technique that just kind of flows naturally with me. And so, no, I don't do all of the past at once or all of the present at once. I tend to go back and forth, and I jump around a lot. Like, when I write a rough draft, it's kind of all over the place, and it's not chronological at all. Even, like, the present-day stuff I have sort of out of order, especially when I'm writing from multiple characters' points of view. I'm really scattered. My first drafts are, if you could see my first drafts, you would be like, wow, this is really bad. They're long, rambling messes that make no sense. They go in a million different directions, but they do go back and forth through time. And then once I get my rough draft, and I feel like maybe I've reached the end, but I'm still wondering, what's the story here? What's going on in this book? I take it and I do that same technique. I take it and I lay it out all over the floor of my house, and I start moving things around. And I think of it almost as like the collage part of making the book. You know, it's something that's necessary to me, this visual thing. So I have all the chapters laid out. And my family loves it when I do this. And I tell my daughter, you can't play in the living room because part one of my book is laid out there. And I start, you know, I walk through it and I walk back and forth and I walk over it and I move. I say, well, this doesn't belong here. And this needs to happen later in the book. And this should happen much earlier. And gosh, there's a whole section missing here. This, something else needs to happen here. And this doesn't belong in the book at all. Let's just throw this out entirely. So I do that. And then I've got a big mess all over my floor of jumbled pages and notes and blank pieces of paper that I've written notes on saying, insert chapter about XYZ here. And then I do an outline, and then I get all organized, because I haven't been organized at all until now. But then I need to do an outline to make sure that everything works, because my books are a little complicated, because I don't just have one storyline going. I've got 2, sometimes even more. And I need to make sure that everything works and that it flows naturally together, like the past and the present, so that it's not jarring for the reader, hopefully. And that's when I get all technical and I do my outline and I do like timelines and I start making maps and I do character histories and I figure out when people were born. When I wrote The Winter People, I did maps of the town. I did maps, the maps of the town in the present day, maps of the town in 1908. I did maps of the farmhouse and the land around it because the landscape is a huge part of this book. Sarah's farmhouse and the woods behind it. She's got these wonderful, creepy woods behind it and a hill. And at the top of this hill, there's this area, a formation of rocks called the Devil's Hand. And everyone in town thinks that this is a really haunted, creepy area. And there have always been legends and rumors and supposed disappearances. And people see ghosts and aliens. And Ruthie's boyfriend, Buzz, believes it's a UFO hotspot. And he's seen aliens up there. And so the landscape is a huge important part, and I had to draw it all out. So I drew the devil's hand, and I drew like the different ways you could walk up through the woods to get to the devil's hand. And I have a scene in caves at one point in the book, and I had to make a map of the caves and show in my map where everyone entered and exited and where people were at different points in the book. So I get a little more organized in spite of not starting out from an organized way of doing things at all. But, yes?
Do you base any of your characters on people you knew or know now or just in your life?
That's a good question. The question is, do I base any of my characters on people I know or ever knew in my life? Not knowingly. I mean, I think there are definitely bits and pieces of people I know in some of my characters, but I often don't recognize it until later. Just like there are pieces of, I feel like there are pieces of myself in a great deal of my characters. But no, you know, and I know writers who do that, who like write a really recognizable character from someone from real life. And I can't do that. It's more fun for me to completely make things up, you know, to just kind of mesh things and invent and do that. And my first book, Promise Not to Tell, so I set all of my books in fictional towns, and for the most part, they're all set in Vermont. And I set all my books in fictional towns, and when I sat down to do my first book, Promise Not to Tell, I actually set it in a real town in Vermont. And then I was about halfway through it, and I realized, I can't do this. Because I'm writing like things about the fire chief and the postmaster and like the guy at the general store. And even though they looked and sounded and acted nothing like these real people, they were obviously going to see themselves, and everyone was going to be pointing fingers and saying, I think I know who she's supposed to be. And, you know, and I realized I was going to get in trouble because I lived here and I knew these people. So I fictionalized it. But people still did that anyway. They were like, I know who that guy is supposed to be. And I said, no, really, it's not. Yes.
So when you fictionalize, you say you fictionalize your towns.
Yes.
Do you base them on towns kind of sort of, you know, although they're fiction, when you're creating a description, mm-hmm. is it some place that you theme that you're describing?
Okay.
I don't know how your imagination
Sure. The question is, when I create a fictional town, how much, what, where do I get that from? Do I get that from real towns, and do I base that on a real town? And what I do is, I base it, particularly in the winter people, I had two or three small towns in one area of Vermont that I was looking at and studying their history. And we have a really great historical society, and I have a really great history section in my local library. And they had these great books with pictures and maps of these little towns that I was thinking about that showed the maps of town back then and the maps of town now and what's changed and what stayed the same. So I was inspired by that. I didn't actually copy any of that. I looked at things like the towns had town greens, and they, you know, where they had concerts, and all these towns had stores. They had a general store that was very much the center of the town. And so I borrowed things from here and there. And when I actually sat down to map my town, I just completely made it up after studying all these maps for a while. I made up this fun little town of West Hall, Vermont. And I can't draw at all, but I have fun. I get out my colored pencils and my Sharpies, and I label everything, and it's fun. And I'm a big fan of huge sheets of newsprint, so I have maps and charts going with huge, I have the big newsprint sheets all over my office, and my office gets a little chaotic when I'm in the stage. Yes?
Do you ever visit cemeteries and find old
things? The question is, do I ever visit old cemeteries to get names? Because some of the names in my book sound like they come from tombstones. Yes. Vermont, we are known for our maple syrup, but we are also known for our granite. The granite industry is huge, or was huge, and there are still granite quarries in Vermont. And we have some amazing cemeteries. We had all these incredible artists from Italy coming and working in granite once upon a time. Like Barry, Vermont, right next to Montpelier where I live, was the granite capital of the world. And there's a cemetery in Barry, Vermont called the Hope Cemetery. And if you guys ever get a chance to go to Vermont, go to the Hope Cemetery because it is incredible. There are just stones there that are works of art. They are gorgeous. And when I used to live in Barry, it was walking distance to my house, and I would spend a lot of time there. I would walk the dog through there. And I totally did. I looked through for names. And I never took like a first and last name completely and put it in the book, but I would write down interesting first names and interesting last names and mix them up. And now that I live in Montpelier, of course, I live close by two other wonderful cemeteries that I visit quite often. And yeah, and it's not only are the names inspiring, but it's just so interesting to look at it and to look at the dates and to think about, you know, the lives these people must have led and like the families with all the young children who died and just wonder what the stories are and the men who had several wives. And it's just, it's interesting. There are a million stories that you can imagine walking through the old cemeteries. Yes, great sources of inspiration. And also, you know, so along the name thing, I also got a lot of name inspiration from looking through old, when I was researching for the winter. So when I decided that I was going to set this book in 1908, I was completely intimidated because I'd never done anything like that. I'd never done anything historical before. And I thought, I am out of my league. What am I going to do? And I knew that I was wanted to tell Sarah's point of view through her diary. And I really, it was so important to me to get the voice right. So I went out and I just immersed myself in letters and diaries from that time period in New England. And I read all about farm life in early New England. And it was just really fascinating stuff, even just reading the letters. And so that was really important to get the names right, to get the voice right. But also, I just came across some wonderful names when I was doing that research, like Hester. I think that name came from, I think that name was in one of the diaries that I was reading. And yeah, there's great stuff out there. Yes.
What did you do prior to writing?
The question is, what did I do prior to writing? A little bit of everything.
Obviously, you're educated. Is there literature or history?
Well, I've been writing forever. I wrote my first story, my first short story, when I was in the third grade, and it was about a haunted meatball. And in some ways, my writing hasn't changed all that much, or I've come full circle. I wish I still had my haunted meatball story, but I don't. I could try to recreate it. Maybe I shouldn't. So I've been writing ever since, and I felt that haunted meatball story was just this pivotal moment for me because I realized I could do this amazing thing where I could create a world where anything could happen, including making a meatball glow green and come to life and roll across the table and haunt this little boy who tried to eat it. You know, that's wild stuff when you're in third grade. And then my next story was about a mud monster, and the thing that I think really hooked me into it was my teacher at the time said, this is good. And that's all it took. And then I ended up taking a creative writing class over the summer between third and fourth grade, and I learned about simile and metaphor, and I kept writing. So I've been writing forever. And then I studied writing. I studied poetry in college. So I studied college. I've studied poetry at Goddard College in Plainfield, Vermont. And so I spent 4 years doing that and really immersing myself in poetry. And I knew that I didn't want to teach because I'm just not drawn to it, and I think that I'm a terrible teacher. So I thought, well, I'll just be a poet and do whatever it takes to support myself. So I wrote my poetry, and I painted houses, and I worked on a farm, and I worked with folks with mental illness, and I did a little bit. I did whatever it took to pay the bills, you know. And then I went to grad school for a year in an MFA program studying poetry, and my poems were kind of morphing and starting to change, and they were getting longer and more complicated, and I was writing these prose poems that just went on and on and on. And one day I start writing this prose poem that's like, suddenly it's 10 pages long, then it's 25 pages long, and it just keeps growing. And I'm like, oh, this is not a prose poem. This is a short story. And it keeps going. And I'm, no, this is not a short story. This is a novel. And I have a panic attack because I think, what do I know about writing a novel? What do I know about fiction? Nothing. I've been studying poetry for 5 years. And I could do language, and I could do metaphor, and I could describe things really well. But if you want to write a novel, you have to have this thing called plot. And I didn't know a thing about how to do a plot. You have to make things happen. So that was the thing that I had to work the hardest on, was plot. And I ended up decided to take a leave of absence from the MFA program and from poetry and see where the novel writing thing would take me. And I haven't looked back, you know. Yeah, and that helped a lot. And, you know, I miss writing poetry. I do. And now every time I sit down to write a poem, it turns into the beginning of another novel. It's crazy. And when I'm stuck in writing fiction, I'll close down my computer and I'll walk away and I'll read poetry. And that will get me unstuck every time. Just the language. And I'll go back to some of my favorite poets. And of course, my favorite poets are sort of the dark, tormented ones like Sylvia Plath and Anne Sexton. And if Oh, Poe. Absolutely. Poe is wonderful. But Anne Sexton has this wonderful book called Transformations. It's kind of her take on the classic fairy tales. Oh, it's wonderful, dark, creepy stuff. Love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. Yes.
The covers for your books, that's how I found you. I was just on Amazon one day, kind of going through the books, and that drew me in. I wanted to know, like, they all seem to have the same theme. This one's kind of different.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of curious.
Okay, the question is about the covers of my books, and sort of the story of the covers of my books. They are different. So I've written 6 books. My first 5 were with HarperCollins, and my first 5 books all have young girls' faces on the cover. And they're very striking because they all have young girls' faces on the cover. And I am now published by Doubleday, and I felt strongly that because it was sort of almost like a new beginning. It was a new publisher, a different sort of book for me. I wanted to have a different kind of cover. And I talked to my editor about what my dream cover would be for this book, and I said, I want something that captures the landscape and the feel of the book. I want something that captures the haunting image of the farmhouse and the woods. And they came up with this, and I think it's so beautiful. I have it on my desk, and I just stare at it. And anyone who comes into my office, I'm like, I make them touch it. I say, touch my cover, because it's like embossed and raised, and it's got this pearlescent paper, and it is a work of beauty. And I love my other covers too, and I hear that from people that they're in a bookstore and they stop and they stare because they see a little girl's face staring at them. The names are, and The Winter People is actually, well, no, that's not, Dismantled and The Winter People are the only 2 books that I have kept their titles from beginning to end. And the others, I had title nightmares. My first book, Promise Not to Tell, was The Potato Girl when I was writing it. And was The Potato Girl when it was first about to go out into the world, and then it was kind of changed around at the last minute. It became Promise Not to Tell, and which I think is a better title. And you know, and at the beginning, they showed me this great, what I thought was a great cover for when it said Potato Girl. And it had this very sort of creepy, like sepia-toned image of a truck in a field and sort of a ghostly figure on it. And I was like, oh, that's good. And then they do this thing where they take the book to marketing meetings, and all the salespeople and people who actually know what will sell look at it and talk about it. And they said, no, this isn't going to work at all. So they reworked it, and then they came up with a cover with the girl's face, and we came up with a Promise Not to Tell, and it worked. And it's been great. And I'm really excited to be moving in a different direction with this. However, I've heard from a couple of people who are like, I miss the girls' faces, and but it's time for a change. So it's all good. Yes, another question. How long does it take me to write a novel?
Probably
average around a year, sometimes longer, sometimes less, depending. And that includes like the initial getting it all out on paper, and then the revising and endless revising. And sometimes it does take a little longer. The hope is that I would like to be able to put out into the world a book a year. So I'm going to aim for that. It might be a little bit more, but I don't want to put anything out that I feel like isn't the best that I can possibly do, too. So, but I when I'm into a story, I work really hard. I'm working all day, and I'm just all fired up and going, going, going. And this book, Winter People, we worked really hard. I edited this so fast and put in so many hours because we felt like it was really important that it come out in the winter. You can't have the Winter People come out in the summer. So we were on this super tight editing schedule to get it out, and I'm excited that it's here out in the winter. Perfect book for a winter's evening. Any other questions? Don't crank them out too fast. No. Yeah. Yeah. I know people, and I've met people who do like 2, even 3 books a year, and I can't imagine doing that. I think that my brain would just keep spinning and spinning, and I wouldn't have time for anything else. And you know, I have a life and a family, and there are other things. Writing is super, super important, but there are other things in life that are really important too. Well, okay. Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.